You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
So, when did you first know you were
a mutant?
But you cut that out.
You have to understand, we thought Bobby was going to a school for the gifted.
Bobby is gifted.
We know that. We just didn't realize
he was... We still love you, Bobby. It's just... this mutant problem is a little...
What mutant problem?
Complicated.
What exactly are you, Professor F, Mr. Logan?
Art.
Well, you should see what Bobby can do.
I can do a lot more than that.
Ronnie? This is all my fault.
Actually, they discovered that males are the ones who carry the mutant gene and pass it on, so it's his fault.
Hello and welcome to the 602 Club. I'm so excited to be here as we come from Mutant High. Yeah, it's so nice here. And I gotta say, the house is a little bit different this time, but it's still looking good. I'm feeling comfortable. I love all the wood paneling. And I'm glad to have with me again to talk about some more X-Men, the one and only Sean Eastridge.
Hey, Matt, thank you for having me. And I really do like what you've done with the place. It feels a little bit more homey. I feel like there are more people around. There's some more camaraderie happening. People are just watching TV. Everyone's hanging out after midnight, eating ice cream, watching television. So it's nice. There's a good vibe.
Yeah, what's nice about it is we just had more money so we could get more extras, you know.
I like that. I like that. We should do that. Definitely keep that up.
Sadly, there's no beer. It's a school. So, you know.
That's all right. I'm good with whatever Dr. Pepper.
I love that he pulled off Dr. Pepper.
Whatever the sponsor for this movie was, I'm good with that.
This film has been brought to you by Dr. Pepper. When Wolverine can't have a beer, Dr. Pepper will do.
It quenches his thirst.
I don't always drink soda, but when I do, I make it Dr. Pepper.
And then throw in a, like, just the claws coming out.
Yeah.
And he pops the bottle with the claw. Perfect. We got it.
Oh, man.
That's your marketing scheme, Fox. Run, go back in time. Change it up.
I don't know why they're not doing it. But before we dive into X2, just a quick reminder, you can find us all over the place. Trek FM is everywhere. One of the best places to check us out is over on iTunes, itunes.com/Trek FM. We've got so many shows here on the network. Of course, the 602 Club. And hit us up with star rating review, letting people know what you think of the show. You know, you can share the show on Twitter. You can follow us at Trek FM or on Facebook at facebook.com/Trek FM. We've got a listeners only discussion group over there on Facebook called the Babel Conference. A couple of different ways to get there. One is to type Babel into the search field in Facebook, or you can go over to the website at trek.fm and any of the show pages, there's a menu bar and you'll see discussion. Just click that and that'll bring you over there. And while you're at the website, go to trek.fm/contact, choose a show. Choose the 602 Club, and that will allow you to send an email to the show, and then it'll come to me and any of the hosts that week, and we can talk to you about whatever you'd like to talk about. So,
dear Matt, I think you should have Sean on the show. Sincerely, Anonymous. Great. Okay, I sent my message.
Okay.
I mean, someone sent a message. I don't know.
Wait a minute. You're here.
Oh, what? Oh, yeah. Hey.
Man, look at that. Talk about quick wish fulfillment.
There we go. Just what the people want.
Well, I wanted to ask you, because I think this is interesting. I was watching the behind the scenes, and you know, this movie kind of picks up where we leave off in the first one. But what was most interesting to me in doing that was that even Bryan Singer mentioned something on the extras that we had kind of mentioned, which is that the movie is good, but that it's not great.
The first movie.
Right, the first movie.
Right.
And I thought that was really interesting to hear him kind of feel like he had been, he even, his own words were, I felt like we were kind of creating a trailer for a better movie.
That's, I feel like he, I don't know if I subconsciously picked that up from him, because I think I said that in the episode we did, and but it does feel that way, and I know a lot of people felt that way, so maybe it was just this kind of osmosis of Singer recognizing that and saying, okay, well, the second time around, we've really got to up the ante and make it a better experience, make it a fuller experience, more exciting, more emotional, but... Yeah, I mean, there's a sense with X-Men 2 that he really was like, I'm going to prove everybody who was kind of let down by X-Men that I've got the chops to make this work.
Well, and on top of that, though, too, you know, there's a very big difference between doing Superman or Iron Man, just one character that you have to introduce, and having an entire ensemble that you have to introduce, and a world that is all its own, you know. X-Men has so many different things going on in it that I do feel that, you know, I think he did the best job he could with trying to introduce that many characters and this world, this milieu for X-Men to hang out in. And that's what really frees him up. They do such a good job of that in the first movie that they really can just hit the ground running in the second movie.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that was, as we discussed, the first X-Men movie came out at a time when superhero movies were not respected. They were not only were they not respected, they were no longer seen as commercially viable. They were jokes. They were parodies. It was Batman and Robin, Joel Schumacher. You had something like Blade, but again, it was still kind of, that was a little under the radar. X-Men was a mainstream superhero movie that proved that superhero movies could be serious and could be good. Like, they could be considered like, oh, this is actually good cinema. And I think there was a lot of pressure on Bryan Singer and probably a lot of pressure from the studio. They probably put a lot of boundaries on him and were like, we have this budget. You can't go above that. You can only do this many things. There were a lot of constraints with X-Men 1, and a lot of that came probably from the need to prove that they could do it and that it could be popular. And when that happened, and when it was kind of like, okay, people like this, the reins are kind of loosened a little bit. And you feel like Singer's kind of going with the shackles off. He has a little bit, there's a vibe right from the get-go of this movie where you feel like, all right, we're in for like a really awesome ride here.
I mean, you can tell right away that not only do they have, you know, it feels like probably more time behind the camera, but they have more money, you know, because,
yes.
I mean, we really do start off with a bang with, you know, the whole Nightcrawler scene, and it's still an amazing, fantastic scene. Like, it still works so well.
That blew, I remember seeing that in the theater, and this was 2003. I was in high school. I think I was, let's see, 2003, I was a sophomore and in high school. I was about 16. X-Men, the first one, was like my favorite movie. I when that came out, I loved it. I was so excited for the second one, and my theater going experience was one of the best I've ever had. That was the first time I went to a movie and the audience cheered, applauded along with, I'd never seen that. I was like, oh my God, this is like an event. This is amazing. And that opening scene was like, you just felt it. You felt the energy of the audience just kick up to a whole other level. And you compare it to, I mean, the X-Men 1 opens with a scene, a very somber recreation of the Holocaust, like Auschwitz. And you can see Bryan Singer is like, all right, people are taking us seriously, so let's just have some fun. And you kick it off with this amazing action sequence, visually stunning. It still holds up today. Even the special effects, the seams kind of show a little bit, but it's still so impressive. That one shot where Nightcrawler is going around the room, beating everybody up, and everyone's going flying, it still is like, man, this is so cool.
Well, and one of the neat things is I was just looking at the way that they did the effect and the smoke effect and everything that they use. It helps cover up the CGI-ness of it.
Yes.
You know, they chose something that ages well. There are other effects here that do not age well whatsoever. but this scene really kicks off this movie in a way that lets you know that this movie is going to ratchet up everything that we had in the first movie. And part of that, too, is like this action scene doesn't just ratchet up the action itself. It's bringing to new heights the thematic elements right at the beginning that humans and mutants are coming closer and closer to being in conflict. And right. That's what I love about the scene, is it's not just an action scene. It is very much driven by what's happening in the story that you just don't know yet.
Right, which is the brilliance of the first two X-Men movies, I think, and something that was sorely missed in some of the sequels. But the whole subtext is there right from the get-go. The action is being driven by the story. Like you're saying, it's a great action sequence, but the cherry on top of that action sequence is that at the end of that you have the mutant freedom now. Like, that drives the paranoia of the government, of society, that fear is what drives the rest of the plot, and that kicks everything off. And it is such throughout this movie, more so than the first one, you feel the action and the plot and the characters go much more organically together. It feels like, I mean, Singer was really cutting his teeth. He'd never done a big action movie before on the first one. And this one, you feel him really, like, he's kind of settling in. He's like, all right, I like this. I feel more comfortable. I feel more in my element. And I think that also freed him up a little bit to not look at the set pieces as like, okay, we need set pieces and then we have the story. They both really organically go together in this movie in a way that is extremely satisfying, and you kind of see its influence in other movies later on as well.
And I think that's something that's so important, you know, and I think honestly that is one of the things that I would say in the Star Trek movies with that J.J. Abrams did, especially the first one, the action told the story.
Yeah.
If you're
yeah.
paying attention, the action is helping tell the story. And so the same thing I do think really happens in these movies, that anytime that there is an action sequence, there's something happening with some of the characters, you know, whether it's, you know, when they're in the X-Jet and you're getting story that's happening with, you know, what's going on with Jean Grey, and what's going on with the kids that are in there. You know, like, none of this is just let's throw in a really cool action sequence because it'll be amazing. You know, even the I mean, to spoil it, of course, this movie's, you know, 2003.
It's 15 years
yeah,
old.
Get it.
Can you yeah. believe that?
I couldn't believe
that. I realized as I was watching, I was like, wait a second, we're almost at the 15th anniversary of this thing. That's nuts.
But, you know, you think of the fight with Wolverine and Lady Deathstrike. You know, it's a great action sequence, right? But it also is helping tell the story of Wolverine.
Right.
You know,
and so, I love, yeah. oh my gosh, it's and that sequence is amazing. First of all, we get Wolverine unleashed to this movie like we never have before. And it was great because you almost expected them to pull their punches a little bit, because it's a PG-13 movie. Obviously, we're not getting into Logan levels of violence, but there is a level of like, oh, Wolverine's taking out people. He's going full on berserker rage. And that scene in particular, it's amazing to me sometimes that it got a PG-13 rating, because it's so brutal with what they're able to get away with. But like you said, that moment, that scene is also punctuated by this really heartbreaking moment where Deathstrike kind of comes into, she comes back to reality, and she has that moment where she's like, what just happened? Oh my God, I'm dying. You killed me.
Yeah.
And it's Bryan Singer, what I loved about his work with the first two movies is he's not never too far from punctuating his scenes with moments like that. Very small character moments. This movie has a lot of beautiful moments between the action, between the plot points, where you can sense another director less comfortable with kind of taking things slow and letting the audience kind of find the emotional.
Somebody
beats.
Like Brett Ratner, maybe?
I don't know. Maybe, just maybe, but that's what made that hurt all the more, because I remember X-Men 1 and 2 felt like a film school to me. It felt like this is how you make a movie and make it feel like elegant, but also how you can fill a movie with subtext and emotional beats. Like the moment where John, a.k.a. Pyro, when they go to Bobby's house and he's just looking
yeah.
at the photos on the wall, a family. Like he's never had a family. He doesn't know what that's like. He can't, you sense that longing. And it's like, it's a brief moment. You get the sense like this could have been cut out of the movie, but you lose so much of John's character and you lose that. There's a melancholy that still runs through this that was in the first movie. And you have the fun of the movie. This is way more fun than the first one. It's looser. The jokes hit better. But at the same time, you never lose that sense of drama and seriousness that was in the first movie.
Well, and I think what you're talking about there is something that's really interesting to me, because there's this whole thing of it's a blessing and a curse in the film, and the idea of what it means to be a mutant. And, you know, it could be a huge blessing to be one with the cool things that you can do, but it can also be a terrible curse. One, it could cost you your family, possibly. Two, you could be like Rogue and not be able to ever touch anyone. I mean, it's just there's this real sense that this movie deals with these powers in a way that allows you to experience what it would be like to be one of these characters, but not in a cheesy way, but in a way that bases them in reality that honestly, I don't know if we had seen done as well until, I mean, I think of, Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy.
Yeah.
And I think, I personally think that's what they do with the reality of what it means to be Clark Kent in Man of Steel. Like, what do you do with these powers? How do people react to me? You know, like, that's what they're doing here and I think it's just, it's nice because the movie is taking its world seriously. And therefore, as you watch it, it's not a joke. You are caught up in the drama of what it means to be these people. And it makes you feel for them, which makes you care about what happens to them as you move through the movie. And Singer does a great job of making that happen for you.
Yeah, X-Men 1, if there's any complaint I could lobby against it, it felt way too serious. It almost felt a little like it was scared to have fun. There's a lot of subtext in it about the civil rights and things like that. He brings all that subtext into this movie. There's even kind of the allusion to homosexuality, like Bobby coming out to his family. Oh, I'm a mutant. You know, that kind of, have you tried not being a mutant? All that stuff is there. But this feels like, it does feel like a comic book movie. Like he found an incredible way to meld those two worlds and to not necessarily get rid of the themes. He was able to fit in the more, not cartoonish, but the more comic book level action and superhero stuff that I think he was maybe a little gun shy with in the first one, but he melds it so well with the character beats and the moments that you're able to get those set pieces with that undercurrent and that subtext. But you also, X-Men 2 kicked the action up to a whole new level for superhero movies. I still think this stands as one of the best. I mean, it's hard now with Marvel's cinematic universe to rank these superhero movies because they almost now have their own categories. But like X-Men 2, I feel like if I were to look at it, it's still probably like a top 5, top 10 at least for me. And so much of that just comes from the crowd pleasing element of it, like the X-Mansion scene. You have these great, great moments of, you know, Colossus coming out. You have Wolverine. Like I said, he goes nuts and he takes out a bunch of guys, and that's great. But then you add to it the beauty of that moment where he sees Stryker. He meets Stryker for the first time, played by Brian Cox, who I absolutely love in this movie. And that moment of Logan's like, who are you? Why, how do you know me? And then Bobby cuts him off to save him. But you have that beautiful shot of Wolverine kind of reaching up to the ice and the shadow, the silhouette of Stryker reaching back to him. That followed one of the best action sequences I think I've seen in a superhero movie and maybe in any action movie. You have this quiet moment of just like this visual beauty. And I love that. And I love what Singer was able to do there, and that he felt the confidence to really go for it with the action, that he didn't feel ashamed of that either.
Yeah, no, I mean, I really agree with you, and I think it's something that, again, as we were talking earlier, the thematic elements in the action meld together to tell a cohesive tale in this film, and that's what makes it so cool, is that they're not divorced from one another. You don't hit the action sequence and think, oh, well, here we are at the action sequence, and,
right,
you know, you get lost in the action, and then they slow it down to get back to the story. No. They really go together. And I think, you know, that's something kind of talking about all these action pieces. the thing of that this is coming down to is that it's a war is coming between humanity and mutants if they don't find a way to stop it. And that what I thought was so interesting is that this is ratcheted up by Stryker, but that Eric is willing to finish and use the same tools to do the exact same thing, which was fascinating to me because the very first movie, as we talked about, starts off with this like very melancholy, very like hard to watch scene of Jews being led into and families separated in the Holocaust. But in the end, both of these men are willing to do the same thing that right. we found so horrible watching in the first movie, and everybody thinks, oh, that's the worst thing ever. We never want to see that happen again. But these two guys are basically making that happen.
And what really makes that work is because it's not a cartoonish, like, I want to rid the world of mutants. You understand Stryker's frustrations and his anger. And at the same time, you understand Eric's frustrations and his anger. They've had horrible, horrible experiences that have led them to do terrible things. Things that are not justified in any way, but you understand why. With Eric especially, he's seen the terrible things that can happen to a group of people who have been ostracized and marginalized and put in a corner and enslaved. He's seen the pain of that. He's experienced it firsthand, and he's done. He doesn't want history to repeat itself. Beyond that, he's been imprisoned and he has been essentially tortured and beaten on a regular basis, and he is done. And you just get the sense when he comes into Cerebro and he's like, no, I am done. You tried to wipe us out. You know what? Let's just turn the tables. I'm through with this. And that's
just
what
turn
makes
the
this
Cerebro.
Movie. Exactly. Turn the Cerebro. But it's like, that's what makes it work. It's not a like, I will now rule the world. It's a very personal, there is a strong personal and understandable motivation for these villains. And that's what makes a movie for me. If you can get behind what your villains are saying, even if you don't agree, like, oh yeah, I want the Joker to go around and blow up everybody and things like that. But if you can understand where he's coming from, that to me makes it more effective and more terrifying overall, and only increases the quality of the film. And I feel like Singer and his team, they did such a great job here with really fleshing it out and giving those guys backstories that make sense and motivations that really drive the plot forward.
Well, and it connects with, you know, the first movie, and I think that does really well this whole idea of what you will do when you are fearful of the other side. Mm-hmm. And there's this anger there. You know, and part of that, you know, with Stryker, he is angry because his son couldn't be quote unquote cured of mutancy. And that the inevitable of what his son's mutation was going to lead to something like this. And instead of seeing his son as a person, he just kind of starts to see him as a thing to use to enact this vengeance on mutant kind in general. And yeah. I thought that was, when you're looking at that, you know, Eric is on the other side of that, who's been mistreated and abused in my humanity. And so,
it's basically, in a way, he's kind of the justice for Stryker's son. That Jason has been kind of chewed up and spit out and has this one thing to offer his father. And Eric is kind of the righteous justice for that. Like, he feels that it's his duty to be the justice for that, to be the judge, jury, and executioner on behalf of mutants like Jason, who are just completely dismissed and thrown aside.
Well, and what's so fascinating too about the whole thing is that these two, they're continuing the war because they're just ratcheting up the tension. You know, they're doing nothing to assuage the fear that the rest of the world has on both sides. And I think that's what's so interesting is that they just continue to keep building and building and building until it's ready to explode. And they're really the cause of that. They're the cause of the thing that they're trying to prevent, basically.
Right. And that's the whole thing. And that's, you know, the X-Men are basically the mediator, trying to be the mediator between these two opposing groups, because Xavier and his students are trying to be the conversation that these two sides refuse to have. Because the two sides are like, no. You guys, the mutants, you're going to blow us up. You are going to take us over. They're fearful because it's basically a survival of the fittest situation. These guys are the next step of evolution. We're going to be wiped out. And on the other end, mutants are like, we're being murdered and torn apart and discriminated against. That's not going to happen to us. We have superpowers. Screw all of you. And the X-Men are in the middle. Like, guys, let's just talk. Like, let's just sit down and talk about it. Let's just please try to work together to make this work. And it's the X-Men have always done a really amazing job of more so than others, because the X-Men, by looking at the mutants in this kind of way, it's allowed for the subtext of the like race relations or racism, homophobia, any issues like that, any social issues like that, to really creep into the subtext of this. And X-Men operates in a very gray area where it's hard to find a genuine right or wrong, which is always what I loved about the best X-Men movies, is they really explore that there is the hope is that you would be able to find a peaceful solution, that these two sides can find somewhere to meet in the middle. But the reality is there's kind of a cynicism to the X-Men universe where you feel like this is just a battle that's going to go on and on and on, because these two sides absolutely refuse to communicate with one another or to try to understand each other.
So you're saying what we have here is a failure to communicate.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
I had a question for you, because as we're talking about this idea of like this war and these sides, do you wonder if that the creators of the X-Men actually thought about the idea that the X itself is a symbol which brings points together?
I don't think, and this is with all due respect to Stan Lee, who I mean, he's the man, Stan the man. I don't think he had the slightest idea. You can tell with a lot of these early comics, I think Spider-Man being the exception, Stan Lee, I can just see, I love listening to him talk about how he's like, well, I saw a fly crawling on the wall, and I thought, what if there was a guy who could climb on walls? With X-Men, I don't think he had the slightest clue other than like, oh, X-Men, they're weird and people don't like them. I think it wasn't until Chris Claremont came in and kind of saw the allusions there that I think Stan Lee maybe subconsciously was putting into it. I don't think it was till Claremont came in and started to kind of like, okay, wait a second. I see something here. There's a Malcolm X, Martin Luther King. Like I see what's happening here. Maybe Stan Lee didn't see it, but I see it. But that whole X thing, I love that. I don't think even Claremont, I don't think he saw that, but it's true that it all comes down to that. And it all comes back to that. X-Men really centers around that. There are a lot of, and I love that X-Men 2, the villain teams up with the good guy. I mean, Magneto teams up with the good guys for a bit, where it's like, there's never a clean, it's never like this guy is bad, this guy is good. They can meet in the middle when their missions align.
Which is really interesting align. Because that will really come to fruition in Days of Future Past.
Yes.
Which is exactly. Really nice.
Yeah, and Days of Future Past was nice because it was kind of like Singer was like, okay, no. Here's my X-Men 3. Just sit back and relax. Yeah. I'll try to clean up this
Let
mess.
Me bring that and everything else first class-wise all together.
Right, exactly. So I one of the things about Days of Future Past that I was so excited about that was birthed in X-Men 2 is John Ottman's score, his theme.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about the opening to this movie and how the Nightcrawler scene is great, but even before that, you have Xavier's opening narration, but that opening credits where Ottman's score comes in with that like amazing theme, I get this rush every time I watch it. It's just like, oh man, this feels way more like exciting. I love that. I love that Singer was able to bring that back when he came
back
for Days of Future Past.
What's interesting too is his score I was listening to the other day, and there are refrains that he will actually use in Superman Returns.
That doesn't surprise me.
Which happens to all the composers. I mean, John Williams did it. Like Goldsmith did it. Horner was famous for it. So one of the things I wanted to ask you was, you know, this is the movie that starts us on the road to Dark Phoenix.
Mm.
And I wanted to ask you how you feel like they handled that story. And specifically, I mean, we're going to, in the middle of the podcast, we're going to kind of talk about the end too, because that's really where it comes to light, that this is what's happened. This is where Singer's going. What did you think about that here?
So I, part of the reason, because I know the nerd community kind of has a love-hate relationship with the X-Men movies, because especially these first two, because of the limitations of what they were able to do, because of what Singer wanted to do, they couldn't quite introduce all the characters the way certain fans wanted them to be introduced. Characters like Rogue especially get the short end of the stick. It feels like there is a limitation in that regard. I came to these movies without without the knowledge of the comics. So I went into it knowing who the characters were. I'd seen the animated series, but I was able to enjoy it and kind of like see it as its own story. And to this day, even going back and reading X-Men comics, I still go back to the movies and I'm still like, I love this stuff. With Dark Phoenix, I was vaguely aware of that storyline from the comics, but I wasn't so tied into it or so married to it that I needed it to play out a certain way. I was excited because it was like, oh, I see what's going on here. I know I've heard of this story and I see where they're going with it. And this is kind of cool. And I love that they kind of Wrath of Khan'd at the end with her sacrificing herself and then literally doing the narration from the first movie. It was all like, oh, okay, this is Wrath of Khan. But I loved that. And I loved the last shot of the kind of the Phoenix in the water, this idea of, oh, there's some. There, this is like a promise for something greater on the horizon. I thought they handled it fine in the context of the film. I thought it was handled really well. I love that they tied it into the whole Statue of Liberty incident. Like, it wasn't like X-Men 1 took place isolated from these events. They were like, no, that incident in particular is what kind of awakened these new powers in Jean, and now she's struggling with it. All the whatever the origins in the comics are aside, that didn't really. Wasn't on my mind. I liked that there was a struggle for her, that she had these new powers that she was trying to understand, and that they were able to kind of fit in the Phoenix reference. It worked for me, and I still love it, and I still love watching it and pretending that X-Men 3 was directed by Bryan Singer and that we got a way better Phoenix movie than we did.
One of the things, I enjoy the fact that they were going for this in this movie. One of the things that I was struck by, though, at the very end was there's no reason for her to die. And that's because I was like, why doesn't Iceman just turn all that water into ice?
Yeah, it was very... There are a couple things where they, I know they're like, when Nightcrawler's like, she's not letting me get her. I was like, okay, thank you, scriptwriters, for trying to figure out like, how can we make this make sense? Her sacrificing herself. And it felt more like, I can see the motivation. I can see how you could justify it as like, she feels like she may be losing control. Maybe she feels like this is for the best. She's the only one who can do it. It works so well as an emotional beat that I'm like, I love this. I'm not going to think about it too much, but it's true. It's definitely like, they were like, we needed a big emotional moment. I mean, I'm not kidding. Bryan Singer probably watched The Wrath of Khan and was like, I need that moment in my movie. And they just put the ending of The Wrath of Khan.
And I think I just wish that there had been some more. Because I was thinking back to this again, just story-wise, I wish that there had been more in the film to show her kind of being, like you were saying, maybe unstable, so that there's that feeling of, this is what I need to do. Because like in The Wrath of Khan, there is no other way. This is the only way. And there's nobody else who can do it. It's got to be Spock. He knows it. He, you know, like this... There are too many other options, so I don't feel like this is necessary. So that, and I just, that just came in this watch where I realized story point wise, this isn't actually necessary for her to die. And it's because you have too many people that, well, literally, you just have Iceman who can, you've seen him turn anything into ice, and this is all just water.
I would argue Iceman, they paint the idea that he's not quite, doesn't have full control over his powers.
He's just not quite cool enough yet.
He's not cool enough. Yeah, there you go. I like it. But, you know, he's young. He's still like, you know, he can ice up a Coke, but he can't like, and he can make a wall of ice, but maybe this is something too much for him. He can't, he's not necessarily that powerful. I think Singer just needed an excuse to kind of like, Jean's going to sacrifice herself. We've been building up to this idea that something inside her is about to awaken. I can see what was driving it. I see the ideas like she needs to sacrifice herself because maybe she's terrified of what she's becoming. That will also actually end up inadvertently unlocking this monster. Her sacrificing herself is going to lead into the third movie. It would have been so much better if the third movie had been able to pay that off. Yeah. But
so what you're saying is,
I get what you're saying.
The X awakens.
The X, that's what we need.
Yeah.
That's what we need. That's basically what called. Days of Future Past.
The X awakens. But no, yes. I just, it was something that I just never thought about. And I think part of it is just I'm older and, of course, I've been doing this a long time now for like just talking about films and like the idea of writing. It just had never occurred to me. But then I was like, yeah, there's just something. But, and I think part of that too is knowing how it doesn't pay off.
Yeah,
and it's just
my justification for it would be Iceman's not fully confident in his powers. Professor X is weakened. Jean Grey probably was like, I got to go in and do it. It's like, well, Storm, maybe Storm could create a tornado.
Water spout, you know? I mean, Storm does nothing. Let's just be honest. Useless.
Well, she is. It's. I love, like, the first time you see her, it's like, oh, where'd the accent go? Thank goodness it's gone. Because, man, that was a struggle in the first movie. Yeah, it was not fun to watch. And Halle Berry, she'd gotten her... Had she gotten her Oscar yet? I think she had for Monsters Ball.
Yeah,
she
was like, right. I can't remember.
Because I remember watching X-Men 2, and it wasn't as obnoxious as it gets in X-Men The Last Stand, but like there was a sense like, oh, Storm has a couple extra scenes. She seems a little bit more important for some reason, and it was like, well, it must be because Halle Berry had just won an Oscar.
Well, so speaking of Halle Berry, I would say that her best scene, I think, is when... she is talking to Nightcrawler and they have the conversation about anger and faith, and which is better at keeping you alive. And I really resonated with that conversation because what we kind of see in the movie is that anger leads to what Eric and Stryker do. And Nightcrawler's ability to say, no, we need to have faith in one another and maybe faith in something else beyond us. I thought was really strong, and what was great about it is that it's not just a conversation to spout a theme, but then what you see is that play out then.
Yeah, it pays off at the end when she is like, you know, I have faith in you that you can do this thing, because, you know, he's nervous. He's like, I can't teleport in there. I can't see. And she pays off their conversation by basically saying, like, I believe you can do this. But it's a beautiful moment. This movie is full of moments like that where they treat Nightcrawler, because it's funny in a movie that deals with like mutants and all this kind of cynical stuff to have a character that's very, very strong, like Catholic, like, you know, things like that. You almost wonder, it's like, oh, are they going to treat it cynically? But they treat it so sincerely, as they do with all the characters, very respectfully, very sincerely. And that conversation is a really beautiful moment between this guy who, despite everything he's going through, still holds on to his faith, and this woman who is kind of seeing the worst humanity has to offer and doesn't see, like, you know, what can we do about it? So it's a great moment where they kind of meet in the middle, and like you said, it pays off at the end when he has his crisis of faith at the end.
Well, I like it because, you know, the movie also... In that, you know, you're showing how these different mutants may be pulled to one side or the other, and what could possibly pull them to one side or the other. And, you know, we see that with Pyro. We see that with Storm here. We see that with Nightcrawler. And I just think that that's nice to be able to show how people make the decisions that they make on kind of what side they're going to fall on things because of what their experience is. And I thought it's just another layer here that we're adding to the movie with the the themes that Singer is using, and it's just, it was an, like you said, it's a nice quiet moment between characters. But I also thought it was something that just adds to the overall arching thematic element, because with the idea of Eric and Stryker, you're seeing that even play out within the quote unquote X-Men, you know, and I thought that was really neat.
Yeah, and I mean, it's very the film is full of quiet moments like that. Like another one of my favorite is another Nightcrawler moment, but when Nightcrawler is talking with Mystique and he's like, "You can look like anyone you want. Why don't you?" And she says, "Because we shouldn't have to." Again, a moment that I feel like you have a producer who's like, "Where's the, why isn't anything exploded? It's been 5 minutes." And, you know, I love that Singer keeps these moments in there because it gives the melancholy of these first two X-Men movies is so beautiful and adds this kind of elegance to it and this kind of this emotional vibe. But like, you forget, like, you, I think you mentioned this earlier, but you forget that this is a curse. Like, these people are suffering and there is a desire to fit in, but at the same time, why should they have to conform to these standards at all? The themes are constantly coming up in really great ways. Through the action, we get great character moments, but through the conversation, we get really great variations of the theme of the movie.
Well, and speaking just kind of on those, some of those smaller moments and that create kind of jive with these themes, you know, that scene, I really like the scene with Mystique and Wolverine in the tent.
Yeah.
Because as kind of like, you know, obviously it's kind of a sexy scene, but it's so much more than that because she really is challenging him. What is it that you want? You know,
yeah.
Because Wolverine is a character who doesn't quite know exactly what he wants. And it's interesting to see Mystique kind of challenge that in him, you know, and what's interesting too, is that to kind of offer, look, I, the idea, like, I could be with you. So there is something that is in front of you that isn't complicated, but that's, what is it that you want? Do you just want complicated for complicated's sake? Or is there real emotion there with what you think you have with Jean? Or, you know, because honestly, I will say the one weakness is the love triangle in the film.
Yeah, which is in the comics. To be fair, that is there. But it's tough because I love Cyclops so much, and I love James Marsden so much.
He gets the short end of the stick.
He does, in like every movie. And if you watch Westworld, there's almost a gag
yes.
in Westworld that kind of references the fact that James Marsden is always dying or getting left out. It's great. But I was really hoping, again, X-Men 2 sets up X-Men 3 to be Cyclops' movie. And, you know, these movies are very Wolverine-centric. Cyclops, you know, a lot of people are, oh, he's lame, he's the boy's... It's a lot of the same stuff I hear people apply to Superman that I'm like, guys, but you can tell the right story. Like, you know, it's... X-Men 3 would have been the great opportunity to give Cyclops his due and give James Marsden an opportunity to perform. The love triangle is fun. I like that Wolverine has a relationship with Jean Grey. It's hard because you don't get a lot of... You sense that Jean Grey likes him, but you don't get a lot of moments that justify her feeling, like her romantic feelings for him.
Well, there's a scene, too, that they cut out. The scene where they kind of kiss and everything, there's a moment there that's longer, and they showed it in the extras, where she talks about how, you know, you have fun with the bad guy. The bad boy, but you don't take him home. You don't marry him.
No, that is in the movie.
Oh, it is.
I married the good guy, and Wolverine kind of has that sweet moment where he's like, I could be the good guy. Okay. I like that.
I totally blanked. I don't know why. What in the heck? I just watched this movie.
You were like, man, I wish I was making out with Hugh Jackman.
It's
probably what
it was, honestly.
But I love that. I love. Again, it's a really sweet moment. That's what sells that relationship for me, is that you feel, as tough as Wolverine is, Hugh Jackman plays it so well and so sincerely that you do feel there's genuine feelings there, that he does feel something sincere for her. It's beyond like, oh, Famke Janssen is just beautiful. He does have this sincere attraction to her that goes beyond the surface.
Well, and I part of that, I think, is that he sees in her that kind of, I don't know, I think he sees maybe the wildness in her that she doesn't see just yet.
Yeah.
You know? So, and there's this, there's the that kind of attraction there, the same way that she sees in him that wildness.
Right.
Possibly. So, I don't know. It's not the strongest part of the movie for me, but I enjoy the characters, you know? And I think that's one of the things that's interesting about this movie is them introducing some new mutants. And so, what did you think of the introduction and the storyline we get for Pyro?
I mean, I think it was great. Again, Pyro, they organically introduce a lot of these characters. They all serve a purpose in the story. They all have a really unique function. Pyro's function story-wise is to show the flip side of the argument. A character who is part of... You don't really have... Wolverine's always been conflicted, but as far as Xavier's students, a lot of them are just kind of like, yeah, we agree, we like this. We don't really get a character who starts off in that group and then kind of is like, you know what? Screw this. I don't like this. I'm going to go to this other side because I agree more with them. Pyro is perfect to be that conflicted student who starts off believing one thing and kind of questioning it. And he's at the beginning, he's kind of got this rebellious little streak, but like he does start off with the good guys and end up with the bad guys. And I love that because the whole movie is kind of like, whose side are you on? Which side is the more justified? Who is doing the right thing? There is no easy answer. And characters have to ask themselves that question. And he's the only one of that group who's part of the X-Men who says, you know what? I'm fed up with this and I'm going to go over here. And it works. It's great. And like I said, I love the moment when they're at Bobby's house and he's being kind of a brat. But also you get the sincere moments where you see that there's a heart there, that he doesn't have a family. He doesn't have that in his life and he longs for that. And I think Magneto kind of extending his hand and saying, like, join us and you will be a part of our family is what attracts him there. And again, Pyro is a character that I think everybody wanted to see. He shoots fireballs. That's awesome. But like, again, it's a very organic story device that he plays a specific function and has an arc.
I like that within the character you have, it's like he's part Eric and he's part Logan.
Yeah.
You know, and you put those two characters together and he makes the different choice than Logan does, you know, but he has a lot of the same upbringing as something like Eric. So you've got a connection between those two characters and what I thought was interesting is, and something they kind of talked about in the extras was having the younger class allowed you to play out some of those themes on a different level. And so, you know, Pyro also having the love triangle, basically, where he longs for Rogue and, you know, he didn't really like Iceman, you know, and all that.
Right.
So, I mean, you have that whole, you have layers upon layers of similar stories happening so that they kind of reinforce everything that's going on. And I think that's one of the things that makes it really nice with somebody and a character like Pyro and introducing them. You could tell that the writers had done a very good job of, okay, we're picking these specific mutants and their storylines because it flows with everything else that we're trying to do. It's not just, oh, well, right. Wouldn't it be cool if we had this mutant?
Exactly.
X-Men 3.
Yes, exactly. So, but it's also, you know, it's funny, and you mentioned, you know, because Bobby and Rogue and John, they all have their kind of story. They're the little trio. But what's interesting is Rogue is the least developed of the three.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that carries over into the third movie, and she had... part of that, I think, maybe was in the first movie, she was kind of one of the main characters. She had a more complete arc. Maybe they felt like, oh, in the second one, she can just kind of be there. But it's interesting that that may be the justification for it, because Bobby and John have very defined character arcs. Bobby gets the really nice moment at home where he has that coming out moment, and you kind of sense his sadness, that kind of tragedy there, that this isn't his family anymore and he can't go home again. But Rogue is kind of just along for the ride. She doesn't really serve much of a, she does a couple things to help out, but she doesn't serve much of a plot purpose, which is not a knock against her. I mean, she's fine in the movie, but it is funny that out of the three, it seems like John and Bobby have very defined characters.
And her character is such a hard one to use her powers, you know, like.
Yeah, it is. And they find clever ways to do it. Like when she saves the day with Pyro going nuts on the cops. But then it's, I know I hate to talk about X-Men 3. A lot of I think the any disappointment that comes from X-Men 2 is really just driven by what happened to this series when X-Men 3 came out, and in that movie when she's like, I gave up my powers, and you're like, well, that negates everything that you've been learning throughout the first two movies about living with the curse and all that stuff. So I think that's part of it, is that we didn't get to see her pay off in the third movie, so you really feel the lack of her character in this movie all the more.
Yeah, I have to say, I remember really enjoying this, and I still do, you know, the whole Lady Deathstrike, and what's kind of so cool is how they just keep that hidden, they keep it hidden until the right moment to reveal it, and of course, you know, they have the epic fight.
Right, and Hugh Jack, the Wolverine punchline, where he's like, holy,
yeah,
the audience... I mean, it, like I said, this was the first movie I went to in theaters where it was like people were cheering and like very interactive. I mean, the audience went nuts. It's a moment that still, the moment cracks me up because Hugh Jackman's delivery is just pitch perfect. But in the back of my mind, I'm just remembering the audience reaction to that line because it is so perfect. The build and the comedic beat, the timing of it is just brilliant. It's so good.
What makes her an interesting character, I think, is what you said, is that, you know, for her death, the moment that she is coming out of being under the influence of this drug, and also then realizing what's happening to her. And I mean, I can't imagine a worse way to die than being pumped full of animantium.
You've been a slave. You've been controlled by this guy. You're a slave trying to destroy mutants. You don't have free will of your own. You cannot control yourself. And then you're fighting this guy to the death, but you can't control it. And then you awaken to find, like, oh, all right, see ya, everybody. It's so sad. It's like, you know, we've said it before, we'll say it again, but it's like a moment where you feel the emotional beat there. Beyond the action, there is a sadness, there's a tragedy to it. It's not just like, all right, Wolverine killed somebody, that's awesome. It's like he killed this essentially innocent person who wasn't in control of her actions.
I mean, you feel the weight of the animantium is really what
you
it
feel
is.
The weight, the literal weight of the moment when she clunks on the bottom
I mean,
of that tank.
It's not subtle, the weight of the moment, you know?
So. It's true. Maybe they went a little too far there.
No, I think it's funny because I don't know if we just kind of think in those terms, right? But when you think through the thematic element of what's going on and why they're doing it, it's really good, you know? So,
yeah.
And, you know, sometimes you need to be a little bit more overt. So I have to say, too, you know, one of the joys of the movie is Nightcrawler.
Oh, yeah.
And
Alan Cumming, he's just amazing.
He's so good. And the way that he's able to emote through all the makeup that he has on.
I know.
It's he's just that kind of character that I love how they're able to portray somebody who's had the worst life but still finds a way to hold on to good. And obviously, you know, he was somebody who's being controlled too, because he couldn't help it. So it creates such a fascinating, wonderful, fun character to have. And then he gets one of the best moments, a couple of the best moments in the movie, action-wise and just emotionally.
Yeah, beats are great, and I mean, Cumming is great as Nightcrawler. Very, very sincere, heartfelt performance in a movie full of them. But like, he's kind of the new kid on the block. So, he jumps right in full force, and it's great. And I the future X-Men movies really miss Alan Cumming. I will say that much. It's a shame that they introduced such a rich, thoughtful character, and we never see him again. I mean, you get him in Apocalypse, but it's not Alan Cumming. It's a younger kid who I think is great, but you know, it's I really missed him in X-Men 3. And I was hoping we might see him in Days of Future Past, but you know, whatever. Whatever. You can't get everything you want, so. But he's wonderful in this movie. He's kind of he feels like the heart of this movie, to be honest.
No, I think you're right because I do feel like he drives the emotional center of the movie, and the struggle of what everybody's going through, he's just found a way to already be okay with things. And now he's found a way to be able to help. You know, like, that's been his goal, I think, is to be able to find a way to help. He'd just been used before, and now...
Yeah.
And I think that's something that's really interesting, too, and we really haven't talked about it much, but the idea of how you got Xavier on one side and Stryker on the other, and it's the way that you deal with people. Xavier creates family. Stryker uses people.
Yeah.
I think that's another really interesting thing. And it's also interesting because in some ways, Eric is somebody who's a bit more of a user as well. I mean, he does care about Mystique. There is that relationship there, which we don't necessarily understand yet. But they seem to have a very close... But the rest of them... Yeah, I mean, he just uses Sabretooth, right? I mean,
yeah, you know, it's all about exploiting for his selfish needs, his motivation. Whereas Xavier wants to bring everybody together. He wants to teach them compassion. They're a family. I mean, it's beyond just being a team of superheroes. They are a family, and they care about each other. And I think that's what gives them the edge. Because if what are you fighting for? If you're just fighting for a cause, fighting for someone you love or something you really genuinely care about is someone you care about. Gives you kind of an edge in a way.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And what I think it does too is it shows thematically what the difference between and why, you know, to put it cheesily, you know, love wins, you know, like that the idea of actually caring about other people other than ourselves is what makes this all worth it. And makes one side, you know, better than the other, because intrinsically we know that to be, I mean, you know, we live in a world that doesn't love the idea of moral absolutes, but we know that it's not just about me. Like, even if we don't live like that all the time, we somehow there's something in us that knows that idea. And that's what the X-Men represent. It's not just about us. We're trying to benefit everyone. So I think that's really cool.
Yeah, and Xavier is always willing to extend an olive branch to Eric.
Yeah.
Like, there's never... he's still showing that same compassion, even as Eric is kind of like, no. But they have... I mean, the relationship between Eric and Xavier is one of the most fascinating in all of comics. It's a beautiful relationship, because it's one of the few I feel like we have where it's like these arch rival, like Lex Luthor and Superman aren't best friends. I know Smallville kind of tried to do that. So technically, yes, okay. But I'm talking about, like, in general, Superman and Lex Luthor were not painted as best friends from the start. Whereas Xavier and Magneto, that's the bulk of their comic life, is they have that relationship, that very complicated love for each other and that friendship that's just kind of been twisted through their differing ideals.
Kind of. Coming down to the end, do you feel like, how do you feel like this movie holds up? And then if you had to rate it kind of now, what do you rate, you know, X2, X-Men United?
I might have to knock off a star for that title. No, I think, honestly, I return to this movie every couple of years or so, and it still works for me. Everything about it works. And it's interesting. I can't separate myself from it. I feel like with the latest Marvel movies, everything is so bombastic and huge and amazing and da-da-da. And X-Men 2 reminds me of a time when superhero movies... Part of what I think makes it work is that X-Men 1 was so subtle, that the action was relatively muted, and it gives you somewhere to go in X-Men 2. We have new characters to explore, new action to explore. It makes it that much more effective. And when you have something like the Avengers 1, 2, 3, they saved the world again and again. It's like you can only go so big so many times before it just starts to dilute a little bit. That doesn't change how excited I am for, you know, Infinity War and all that stuff. But going back to X-Men 2 and watching it again, I'd be interested to see how someone watching it for the first time in this, like, oversaturated environment with, like, insane movies with crazy special effects and any action you can dream of would react to it. I think it holds up, and part of the reason it holds up is because it feels like, man, what a forgotten era of superhero filmmaking, when it was character and story that really was emphasized over the need to be like, we have to top ourselves and we have to do this and this explosion and that and all that. The moments of quiet in the movie where it's just like the characters kind of sitting around the fire and camping and all that stuff. I love that. I love the melancholy. I love there are moments where it's allowed to breathe, where again, you're not connecting it to a million other universes. You just have this self-contained story that sets itself up for an amazing sequel that we never got. But I love this movie. I love returning to it. It's probably my favorite Bryan Singer movie. Yeah, it is. But it's one of my favorite superhero movies. I admire it so much, and it makes X-Men 3 hurt all the more when you get that ending of X-Men 2 and you're like, man, they really did not stick that landing. I have to give it 5 out of 5. I love it. I think it's great.
You know, I really like what you're saying there, because you know, when I think of the, like, say, the Marvel juggernaut that we have now, you know, I think what's so interesting about that, and it's something that I was talking about with a friend of the show, John Mills, because we were just talking about Spider-Man Homecoming. You know, one of the things that a lot of the Marvel movies that aren't the mega film, like Avengers, Civil War, you know, a lot of times they can feel inconsequential for what they do for their characters inside their own films. You know, like it's like, okay, it was good, but no, like it didn't really feel like a lot happened.
Yeah, they feel like in some ways, again, this I want to make it clear. I love the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Don't get me wrong. I'm totally a fanboy about it. You can hear me on the Nerd Party on Filibuster with that whole marathon we're doing. You can hear me geek out about it. But there are movies, I feel like, outside of the Avengers movies and the Captain America movies that feel like it's just treading water. It's a way to earn a buck. But in a continuing story, the way they've kind of set it up, this feels like a continuing story. Mm-hmm. And when you have a movie like Civil War and you want to see what happens to those characters next, a movie like Spider-Man Homecoming that's completely separated from it, it's kind of like, okay, great, but yeah, what's going on with that main story? I want to find out what happens. That's why I'm so excited for Infinity War, because you know, I'm just ready to see
where,
that culmination.
Yeah, it's where, you know, all the S hits the fan.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But you know, it with when you have like 15 other movies outside your main storyline, it dilutes the effect of those movies.
Yeah.
I think subconsciously people are kind of thinking like, great, but what is happening with the Avengers and what's going on with Captain America? Well,
and I think the thing that going back here and looking at these X-Men films, you know, the fact that you're getting this continuing story with this group of people, things of consequence obviously happened in this film. So by the end, it's different when you started. You know, it's way different. And so, and I think that there is another thing that is very smart in the sense that it's not coming out every 2 seconds. There's not a new movie every 3 months. And there's something to be said for this idea of allowing there to be time to breathe, because first one comes out in 2000. This is 2003. And it allows you to create good stories, but then it also allows the fan to long for you to be back in that universe again. And so
you miss it. It's if someone's around you all the time, you're kind of like, okay, great, I like seeing you, but get out of my face. But you know, take a couple months off or a couple years off, all of a sudden, oh my God, it's so great to see you again. Well, let's catch up. You know, that's kind of what I miss in this day and age.
Yeah.
I love going back and watching like Sam Raimi's first two Spider-Man movies for the same reasons. It's like you have this very self-contained story. They were going somewhere. Again, they didn't stick the landing with the third entry, but regardless, you have self-contained movies that are telling a story, that are taking the characters to new levels in the sequel.
Well, and it's what I think made, you know, obviously it's one of the reasons that everybody loves Nolan's Batman films, because it's a self-contained complete story. For me personally, others may disagree, but it's one of the things that I have enjoyed about the DC films that they have done, because they don't come out every 2 seconds. But also, too, those series, the stories there are very consequential for the characters that are in them. And it definitely leaves them different than when they came in. So, you know, whether you completely like them or not or whatever, the other part about it is that they're swinging for the fences. And I feel like by the time you got to X-Men 2, Singer and the group were swinging for the fences.
Right.
They're really trying to make something here. And to bring it all back around, all of this is to say, I think this movie still holds up because it understood how to not just make a sequel, but to kind of create that comic book feel of the series. You had the first movie. That's the trade paperback for that. This is the next trade paperback for this part of the story. And then you would hopefully, you know, you're hoping you go on and get more. Yeah. Anyway. But this here, it leaves you feeling satisfied that you've told a complete part of the story here, but you are still looking forward to what's going to happen next. But you don't feel in any way cheated. I feel like I've had a complete meal here. It doesn't even feel like fast food. This feels like, yeah, I went to Chili's, you know?
I got a starter. Yeah, I got the meal. I got a dessert.
I got the apps.
I had some good conversation. Yeah, it was great.
I had a great beer. I mean, you know, like this feels like that kind of thing. Whereas a lot of what we're getting today feels more like it's just fast food. It's just cotton candy. It's in and out and it's done. But this feels more substantial, and I love that about this film. So I'd say this is a good 4 out of 5 stars, because even now I feel like the storyline and everything they're doing still really hold up, which is so fun to be able to go back and say, yeah, a movie that's 15 years old still holds water to everything that we're getting now. That's a hallmark of a good movie.
And for the beginning of the era of superheroes that really was revitalized at the beginning of the 21st century, that Bryan Singer kicked off with the first X-Men, I love watching, you know, you have X-Men 1, you have Spider-Man 1, there are a couple ones we won't mention in between, but then you have X-Men 2 raising the bar. And I love watching, it's like, okay, well, Spider-Man 2, we got to raise the bar for that. And Spider-Man 2 has a similar feel as far as the action feeling more organic, taking characters to another level. It's still
a great movie.
Yeah, and I love that. I love going back and watching kind of they're paving the path. Very similar to what, you know, Burton and Donner did with Superman and Batman. Like, you see kind of the you can go back and you can kind of get depressed by the later movies, but you can go back to the start and say, like, man, that's kind of awesome that Richard Donner basically invented the superhero movie. This is so cool. And I feel like you get the same kind of historical significance from, like, the X-Men movies and the Spider-Man movies.
Yeah. It's so fun to talk about, and I'm really glad we're kind of on this journey to talk about some of these X-Men films. Well, and then sadly, the reason we were talking about them this year was to build up to Dark Phoenix, which got pushed back till next year.
Yep.
So hopefully that'll be good for the film. I am actually interested to see somebody try to execute that story well.
He puts the X in execute.
Yeah, exactly. So let's hope that you know, Simon Kinberg and the group can really do that, because it is a story I would like to see happen.
Yeah, and you get the sense too that this is kind of like, because Disney has Fox now, so X-Men
is
more
than
likely
hurrah. Yeah,
I think it is. I think in a way this is kind of the finale of 20th century Fox's reign that started with X-Men 1. So in
the reign of
you
the X-Men.
Kind of I didn't dislike Apocalypse. It sort of disappeared
kind of
from
there.
My brain.
Yeah,
yeah, it's there.
I mean,
but
it's no X-Men
kind of,
3. Or Wolverine
it's
Origins.
It's true. It's not that bad. But I want them to have a nice little send-off.
Yeah,
me too. I would really like that for this series. Because it's gone through so much. Logan was a nice little fulfillment of that. But I would like to see the X-Men kind of get a nice little send-off before whatever reboot they do that brings them into the MCU.
Well, I'm really glad that we have gotten a chance to sit down and talk about this. It's been a lot of fun, and I really want to say thank you to Ken Tripp and Davis Grayson for their support of the network here through Patreon. Just being my associate producers for this long is fantastic. Their support means the world to me, and it also helps bring every other show that we have here on the network. And so, you guys, this is a huge network and we cannot do it alone. And so we ask you, go over to patreon.com/trekfm. You can see how you can be part of our team. We have a lot of different levels of support. But honestly, in the end, every little bit helps make sure that all the shows that you get keep coming to you each and every week, ad-free, just great content, lots of fun. And so again, go to patreon.com/trekfm and become part of our team. Now, Sean, this has been a blast again, just getting to sit down and reminisce about X-Men.
This is such a great excuse to watch them. I mean, I really appreciate it.
Like, as we needed like, an excuse, but...
but it's great. I do love these movies. And like we were saying, it's so much fun to go back and kind of revisit the more modest era of superhero films. And these are my favorite. I mean, I love Bryan Singer's X-Men movies. They really are some of my absolute favorites. So I really thank you so much for bringing me on.
Well, where can everybody find you if they want to hit you up online or see what you're doing podcast-wise elsewhere?
So if you want to find me podcast-wise, I host a podcast called Missing Frames on the Nerd Party Network. And that's basically a show where we watch movies we should have seen by this point in our lives. Stuff like The Godfather, The Princess Bride, all those movies that it's like, how could you not have seen that? We watch those. We talk about them. It's a ton of fun. If you want to find me on Twitter, I'm at @YayShondorman. And feel free to reach out. Let's talk about the X-Men movies. I love them. Talk about any superheroes movies with me. I love talking about all of them. But yeah, that's where I am.
Awesome, man. Well, you can find me on Twitter at MadRushing02. I'm also on Instagram under the same name. You can find me here on the network with Chris Jones talking about Star Trek Deep Space Nine on The Orb. I'm over on the Nerd Party Network as well with our good buddy John Mills. We talk about Star Wars. That's right. Each and every week we just dive into a little bit of heaven as we talk about the franchise that we all just can't get enough of. So make sure you check it out. Doing Owl Post over there as well with Dre Kaufman as we talk about Harry Potter one chapter at a time. And that is an absolute blast. And then last but not least, talking about films through the lens of faith with my good friend Courtney over on Cinema Stories. And you can find all of the podcasts that both I and Sean do over on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. But thank you so much for joining us. And y'all come back now, you hear?